Hey folks, Fred DeLore here in the iPolitics studio for another episode of On Background. This week I'm joined by Dan Arnold, the former head pollster for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and I'm told by others that he's the one Liberal who knew for certain on election night in 2015 that his party was not only going to win, but was going to win a majority government. And he went on to lead the Liberal polling activities for the 19 and 21 campaigns where he and I went head to head. And currently he's Chief Strategy Officer at Polara. Thanks so much for coming in, Dan.
Happy to be here. Good to meet you in person. I've always read your work, and you've always seemed like pretty reasonable conservatives. So happy to have a chat here.
Well, thanks. I think all conservatives are reasonable, but appreciate that nonetheless. Look, there's probably a million things you and I can discuss, and hopefully we will over time. But today I wanted to chat on background about electoral reform. It's something I've always been interested in, and in my early days in Ottawa, it was a hot topic, more Senate reform back then that we were focused on, at least. And it's remained an on-again, off-again topic. And this week, there was an NDP motion, to bring in a citizens' assembly on electoral reform, which would basically hand over responsibility to them to figure this all out. But that was defeated, and with the bulk of Liberals and Conservatives actually voting against it. So I thought it'd be a good topic of discussion, and Dan, given you were in the middle of the last major look at electoral reform when Trudeau famously said the 2015 election would be the last one that used first past the post, and you folks began to set up a process to do just that, to reform it, I thought it would be an interesting conversation to have on this. So I'd love to jump right in on this and start from the beginning. How serious back then were you folks at actually reforming the system and getting rid of first past the post?
Yeah, so this will be an interesting topic because this is a topic that I think everybody who works in politics or has a poli-science degree or an Andrew Coyne poster up in their bedroom really gets emotional about and has strong opinions about and really cares about. For my work as a pollster, though, I'd say the broader public, it's usually pretty low down on their list of priorities. Right. So that's kind of the starting point that I think I would put out there when we're talking about 2015, in that this was not something that the prime minister, I guess the then third party leader, was talking about in his commercials or a lot in the campaign. I know it's kind of become the signature broken promise of the Trudeau government, the same way like GST was for Chrétien and others. But at the time, it wasn't really, at least in my head, a signature promise for the campaign, because Trudeau was talking about Canada Child Benefit, and he was talking about taxing the wealthy and running deficits to invest in infrastructure. And you know, this wasn't something that really ever, at least in my perspective, was the big vote driver of that campaign. We did a poll actually after that election campaign internally as kind of a post-mortem, you know, why people voted the way they did and lessons learned, but also tested 40 campaign promises and said, like, what do you want the government to focus on? What are your top priorities? And if you rank them by people who said this should be a major priority for government, changing first past the post was number 40 out of 40 in that survey we did. So,
because a lot of people don't even know what that means, I
assume,
right?
Yeah, like people have a tough enough time figuring out, where to go to vote on election day, never mind like what the system is, right? So there's definitely a group who care a lot about this, and I'm sure I'm going to hear a lot about them in the Twitter comments section of this post once this podcast goes up there. But I think for the broader public, it's not a big priority. So, you know, was the government or was Trudeau and the Liberals serious about doing it? Yeah, I think they were serious about doing it. But I don't think it was ever like, you know, seen as being like the defining thing that we're going to do in this government or the defining thing that we want people to vote for us for as a result of that.
It's one of those things, though, where Trudeau, I think, spoke with such conviction when he said it. This will be the last election that uses first pass. And it's clippable.
That's the problem with when you have great poetic prose there. It comes back to bite you in the ass later on. Yeah.
Right. When you're a good communicator and you communicate a message, people tend to believe you'll do it sometimes, right? But I get your point about how it wasn't, you had so many other issues to deal with. There was also a lot of blowback, was there not? Like there's a lot of, or maybe I'm wrong, different groups that were organizing for and against different types of electoral reform. And what was the process looking like in terms of how you guys were going to do this? Because you started down the road a bit, right? You did start to try to do it.
Yeah, I think process is where this one kind of went off the rails, to be honest, because ultimately the decision was made that this had to be a somewhat not heavy-handed way of going about it. So, you know, we tossed around ideas like, you know, a citizens' assembly. And I think in the end, the decision was made to do the parliamentary committee, and you'd have a cross-partisan committee that all the parties could have their say in, and they'd do a report and a recommendation. And, you know, the problem with these things, and we can talk about citizens' assembly, and I hate citizens' assembly for this very reason, but once you give up kind of that control, like, who knows what happens at the end of the day and what the recommendation is going to be. And I think the recommendation that came back was one that the prime minister was not a fan of. And then at that point, you're kind of boxed in and you can't really overturn what they'd said. And I guess you could have put it to a referendum, but then this would be an issue that would drag on for another 3 years and just the public domain. So I think they just decided at that point to, like, you know, rip off the Band-Aid and move on to other things that, you know, are more seen as higher priorities at the time.
Right. It's interesting where the prime minister, I believe he said his favorite, like his choice was ranked ballot. Am I right on that?
Yeah, I think that's what he said publicly on that front. But yeah, again, you kind of open up the box there, and then in the end, who knows what comes out. And I don't think he was a fan of the more PR heavy.
That's a really big change in our system when you go that route. And that's what the NDP and the real proponents of electoral reform seem to be championing, is that complete redoing of our system, where ranked ballot is basically a slight adjustment. It does change the game significantly, but it could be done, I think, pretty easily by Elections Canada in terms of just how you count the ballots, where proportional representation really changes everything.
Yeah, that'd be a much more dramatic overhaul. And I guess on this, and I probably, you know, personally would largely agree with the prime minister on this one. I'm not a big fan of radical reform. I guess right. I'm a small C conservative when it comes to electoral reform, and you are the wild progressive maybe in this conversation here about change. But
I think I just like chaos. I think that's more where I come from.
Yeah, well, some of these other systems can give you a bit of chaos, that's for sure. Although I'd say I'm open to other ideas too. Like I kind of like STV, and, you know, there's some other ones that I'm intrigued by nevertheless.
So what's the difference between STV and ranked ballot?
Well, I'm thinking like the multi-member ones, like where you get like all of Calgary has 8 MPs and all of Calgary votes together. And if the Liberals get 20% of the vote in Calgary, they get, you know, 1 MP or whatever. So it's kind of the multi-member ridings.
Okay.
So, you know, again, I'm intrigued by these things. As I said, all people in politics are kind of intrigued by different models, but it would be a pretty radical switch. And I mean, again, to be honest, this is where I might disagree with actually what the Liberals ran on in 2015. I think if you're going to do a big change like that, I kind of feel like it should go to a referendum of some and have a clear public majority. I don't like the idea of governments kind of getting elected, like maybe we're going to change something and then they change it without kind of getting any kind of public consultation on something that big. So I think that has opened the door for, you know, tweaking a system that favors you or more so. So I kind of feel like it should go to a referendum for something that big if it's going to be an overhaul of our system.
Right. And Trudeau basically said that, right, where not one party, because he had a majority that first term, you could have done whatever you wanted. I mean, maybe this could have been challenged in courts and whatnot, because it is a fundamental change in some regards. But he seemed very clear on that it shouldn't be one party that decides.
Yeah, I think that's where the kind of committee process got set up. But then, you know, then it was sort of out of his hands.
Then it gets so political, though, too, right? Like, I think that's one of the things where it makes electoral reform so difficult. Political parties look at it through two lenses. One is what's going to help us in the next election. And two, we're in opposition, we're going to screw with the government. So there's two different angles there that they take. That makes it very hard to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge self-interest component to it, right? So in that respect, you know, you get four different parties with competing priorities. It's going to be hard to get any kind of consensus there when people are looking at it through the partisan lens of what benefits them, even if sometimes that's a little short-sighted, but people are still looking at it through that perspective.
I find ranked ballot funny, almost like peculiar that we don't use that. Like, first past the post seems so archaic and strange. And as a conservative, we elect our local candidates through ranked ballot. We elect our local executive through ranked ballot. We elect our national council through ranked ballot. We elect our president of the party through ranked ballot. We elect our leader through ranked ballot. But when it comes to parliament, it has to be first past the post.
Well, that's where I'm coming from, too. Like, I think it's something that gets used. And, you know, I don't think we're asking too much of people to, like, put a 1-2-3 on the ballot. It's not rocket science there. So I think
and
that's
it's not hard for Elections Canada to count that.
Yeah,
you just
yeah,
need
you,
to amend what the ballot looks
votes
like.
And, you know, so I think it's something that would be a pretty simple change. And that's why I kind of like it. I think that's something that, and it would, I mean, everyone always assumes like ranked ballot would help the Liberals because they're a centrist party. But I'm not even convinced of that because it does take away the kind of NDP voters, you have to vote for us to stop for these evil conservative strategic vote argument at the end of the day, because they can still vote NDP and put the Liberals second. So I'm not even convinced it would be that beneficial to the Liberals at the end of the day, but I do think it's something that would at least ensure that people who get elected have a larger group of voters in their riding who are at least somewhat supportive of them.
Right. If you look at the, you know, perceived math, it would negatively impact conservatives for what same point you made. And I don't know if that's true either. I think there's different voter groups that go different ways that we just assume all the Greens go Liberal. Well, we saw where the Greens in the last election where they didn't run candidates, a lot of them went to the People's Party. And there's all these different scenarios that could play out. So I think at the same time, the Conservative Party and Liberal Party would both adapt to whatever the system is. Whatever's in place, there's always going to be two competing parties.
Yeah, and it's funny. I remember doing focus groups last election campaign, and like there was a People's Party voter who somehow got into it, who had voted Green before and hated pipelines, but was upset with vaccine mandates. And yeah, people are complicated. They have different perspectives. And like you said, I think you're right. I think if the system changed, parties would adjust accordingly. Like, I think this is an area where, you know, everyone complains that people in the U.S., you know, win the Electoral College while they lose the popular vote. And I'll actually, like, I hate to do this, but I will defend Donald Trump to some extent here. In
wow.
that, like,
okay.
This
is going to be very clippable. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can put this up online as the MAGA liberal pollster here. But, like, when people say, like, Trump would have lost if it was, just straight out, like, most votes wins the election. It's not true, because he would have campaigned in California and other places, and like people
right,
have changed their strategies.
And very good point.
So I think and maybe he would have lost anyways, but I think, you know, parties adapt. And if it was a different system, parties would adapt. I teach a course on election campaigns with the MPM program at Carleton. And one of the thought exercises I like to take students through there is like, okay, if Canada changed to a proportional system, how would that change for the parties? If we change to mandatory voting, well, then we're going to be more focused on persuasion as opposed to mobilization, right? So, you know, strategies would change by the parties if the system changed, and, you know, that could have big implications.
Mandatory voting is something that'd be very interesting. In Australia, they have that. Any other Western country that...
I'm not sure. Australia is the example everyone always throws out there when they're talking about it. But I think that would be one that would completely change how, like, people like us do campaigns, right? Because
100%, big part.
The GOTV effort, which is such a overwhelming focus, is suddenly minimized in importance. And you've got to get all these people who, like, probably don't care that they're voting, but are going to have to vote for someone. Like, you got to actually persuade that disengaged voter who normally wouldn't vote and convince them to actually vote for you. So a much more bigger focus on persuasion as opposed to mobilization, which would be a complete change of the way campaigns get run.
100%. Like, a big part of our campaign is IDing votes so we can drive them out. We put so much money and resources, and the whole door knocking thing is to ID vote, not persuade it. So that would completely change the game if it was mandatory voting. Then you're forcing people to vote, though, and they don't have a that has other issues and other drawbacks, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I think, like, and even if you're talking about PRs, and this is where I'm intrigued by things like these, like, multi-member ridings or maybe even a mixed member. Again, I'm not fully there, but the one benefit I would see, and this is kind of my background as a liberal in Calgary for many years,
right.
is like, you know, in my, up until 2015, so my whole lifetime as a, like, partisan, Liberals never elected a single seat in Calgary, even though they got 20% of the vote there most elections. So,
right.
You know, if you had some kind of proportional or multi-member riding, at least those 20% of people in Calgary would get representation, just like the Conservatives in Toronto, zero seats last election. They still got, what, 20-30% of the vote,
mm-hmm.
But they had nothing to show for it, right? So I do think it would at least give that representation, but more importantly, it would encourage parties to actually campaign in those places, right? Because the Liberals would have an incentive to run ads in Calgary and campaign in Calgary to go from, you know, 1 to 2, and the Conservatives would have more incentive to actually put time into Toronto, right? So that was
right.
That would be something where it actually would, again, change the strategies and encourage parties to maybe go to more places and reach more voters. So that's where I see a benefit. Again, I'm not fully sold, but I do see that as a pro of kind of going to one of these other proportional-like systems.
That is interesting, because you certainly need a more national message in that sense as well, right? Where you need to appeal to all of these other cities because you could get seats in them. Now, how would the break, like, you're looking at municipal ridings? Like, how do you base where the boundaries are for this, though? What is Toronto?
And again, I mean, this is where I find where a lot of the other systems do kind of fall down is when you get into the details and like how do we draw rural ridings and how do we assign them? And like, once you get into the weeds of these systems, I do find a lot of other problems kind of present themselves. And then you get into the question of like, do you have lists that the parties are nominating for candidates? In which case, that's not really, in my opinion, at least as democratic, because the voters aren't actually the ones, you know, picking the person.
So you're just voting
for your party. The party leaders are just kind of picking people, and we're back to kind of an appointed Senate situation, except with MPs. So, you know, again, there are some systems where you like you vote for the party and then you vote for candidates, and it's a complicated math. And I think a lot of parties do that sort of thing for delegate meetings as well, too. But, you know, that becomes, again, more complicated than just check the box or 1, 2, 3, like we talked about.
Right. So when you guys abandoned this, when you gave up, do you think it's any type of reform like this is dead? How could this ever move forward now? Like, you had a mandate then to do it. At least, you know, he did run on it and he was elected, and then it was dropped. Is there any future change like this coming down the pipe from any party? I don't see it on the conservative side. I don't see anyone talking about electoral reform other than like, let's add a day to when we can vote, or maybe change, you know, we heard about the secret meeting or the secret plan between the Liberals and the NDP, which seems to be like add an extra day of voting and maybe make it easier to vote by mail, which doesn't seem too complicated.
Yeah, I think changes like that are evolve over time. And I think for sure, yeah, adding extra voting days, or some people have mentioned allowing people to vote outside of your home riding, and if they can find a way to logistically count, like things like that that make it easier to vote, I think for sure we'll keep seeing changes like that.
But that's the focus, making it easier to vote, not changing
the system. I think so.
It'd
just be weird, I think, for Trudeau to kind of, after the high-profile nature of that broken promise, to sort of swing back again. It'll be looked at it as almost like, well, now he's down in the polls, so now he's open to a different system because the system isn't going to work for him. I just think it'll be a tough one for him to walk back from. And I haven't heard the Conservatives talking too much about it. I don't know, was this something O'Toole ever thought about, or like you guys thought about running on it all last time?
I think he mused once publicly about mandatory voting. I think he said that to some interview or something. Read an interesting article and gave his thoughts. But that was the extent of it. It was certainly nothing. My only thing is, if, like, let's say the polls tighten up and we don't get the result that everyone is currently predicting, or most people are predicting. I'm not saying you're predicting it, but right now it looks like Poilievre is going to win the next election. But let's say he doesn't. Let's say Conservatives, for the third election in a row, win the popular vote, but don't form government. I think there could be more and more rumblings, particularly out west, where there's such an overwhelming conservative base that is quite anti-liberal and growing more anti-liberal. There could be, from that, then calls for changes to the system.
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to happen in the short term, maybe long term. But even then, like, I mean, the NDP has been a party that ostensibly talks about electoral reform a lot, but they've been elected in a lot of provinces, and I don't see a lot of provinces voting for PR right now either, too.
That's
right?
Funny,
and
zero provinces.
And I think Legault may have promised this too when he first got elected too, and you know, nothing changed there, right? So that's why I'm skeptical. It's again one of these things where the incentive structures change very quickly once you get elected.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see a province again. Like I said, I'm generally more reticent to doing big changes, but I'd be curious if PI wanted to try something and we could see how it worked out. Like, I think that would be interesting as kind of a case study, or somebody else, you know, and maybe it does lead to better results. But so I think it could happen at the provincial level, and maybe that would be an interesting sort of test case. But it doesn't look like anytime soon, fairly, we're going to see any sort of big reforms happening.
Right. It's interesting. In PEI, the Green Party keeps growing. They've been official opposition there for a while, and they just won an upset by-election last week there. And I'm just assuming that the Greens have a big proportional representation plan. So if they ever miraculously take government in PEI, I wonder if they'll champion that.
And maybe they would be idealistic enough to actually follow through on that.
They may
promises.
Be, right? Because I hear that's one of the things in PEI. They're very dysfunctional official opposition because they're very idealistic.
Yeah.
They don't do the political work that normal government or opposition parties do. So well, obviously I hope the Greens never win there, but if they do, we'll see if something comes from that. The NDP motion on a citizen assembly, you mentioned earlier, like your take on that. But can you go in a bit more depth on that? Like, what would that look like if that had a pass? And if obviously that's just a motion in the House, the government would then have to actually decide whether it wants to do that. What are your thoughts on how that could have worked if the Liberals were engaged in that.
Yeah, and like we've seen a few provinces go down the route of citizens' assembly, and usually that's, you know, citizens' assembly makes a recommendation, then it goes to referendum, and I think it's never passed the threshold in a referendum that's come out of these citizens' assembly mechanisms. I find it weird that people are so in love with this idea of a citizens' assembly for electoral reform, but then nobody would ever dare suggest, like, let's have a citizens' assembly on setting up Canada's climate change targets. Right. Or let's have a citizens' assembly on developing a housing strategy for the country. So I don't know what it is that necessarily people feel like this is something where we need to have 100 people who are, you know, in theory normal people, but then they get, you know, they kind of listen to experts for 2 months, and at that point they're not really normal people anymore because they've sort of absorbed so much more than anybody else who's just sort of passively paying attention.
And who's
picking
the experts?
Who's talking to them and who's briefing them, and you know, who are the people who are even going to kind of accept this? Like, if you're working 5 jobs part time and you're a single mom, like, you're probably not going to give up 10 hours a week to be part of a citizens assembly on electoral reform. It's probably not the thing that's going to excite you to the same extent at the end of the day. So I'm not even convinced, you know, it'd even be like a random sample of Canadians. And, you know, at that point, I don't know why this is something where we would necessarily want to pick 100 people at random to make this big decision when we wouldn't do that for anything else in government. So, you know, that's why I find that curious in terms of why the Citizens Assembly idea has picked up so much steam with electoral reform, but not really on any other, you know, issues.
Well, it feels to the Prime Minister's comments about how not one party should make that decision.
Yeah.
No parties can ever agree because every party is looking at it through their own lens on what's good for their party. And like I said earlier, about also just screwing with the government if you're in opposition. So there'll never be agreement on this. So it feels like that is the only way to potentially do this. But Howard Anglin, who is a very smart conservative and one of a member of Pierre Poilievre's campaign team, he tweeted out on this after the motion was defeated, a very good point about how, you know, this is the MP's job, though. They are elected to do this stuff, not to hand it over to. So similar to what you said, we do elect our parliamentarians to look at this stuff and to make these types of things work or not.
Yeah, and again, I think if there was a big change, I'd be supportive of putting it to a referendum because, again, I think you want that some level of nonpartisan public buy-in before you do any dramatic changes to the system. But, you know, but why you want to pick 100 people in a citizens' assembly to be the ones that design the system as opposed to having some kind of, you know, cross-partisan model that comes out of elected MPs. That's one that's always, you know, struck me as a little bit, you know, curious.
It's interesting. Again, I mentioned earlier when I first got to Ottawa, the big electoral reform for us was the Senate, was changing the Senate. That's the reform roots and the Constitution and all the stuff from the 80s. In the Triple E Senate, that was kind of the base of the Reform Party. There's a, you know, that's, but no one's talking about Senate reform anymore. Now, Trudeau did, in a sense, reform the Senate by at least temporarily taking the partisanship out as much as he could with these appointments. I'll be curious to see if a future Conservative government, I don't think a future Conservative government will try to reform the Senate with an elected Senate anymore because we've tried that. The courts made it clear, like, how difficult this is. Trudeau changed the game by kicking, you know, Liberal senators out of caucus, and now there's independent senators, which are all just small L Liberals instead of big L Liberals, for the most part anyway. I assume the next change we'll see in the Senate will be Poilievre just putting in big C Conservatives again. We'll get Conservative partisans into the Senate.
That's what you're hoping for? Or?
No, I'm sure I'm very low down that list if there's any list being kept of potential appointments.
Yeah, the Senate reform one is an interesting, you know, comparison in the sense that, you know, the Conservatives obviously talked a lot about it and maybe did raise expectations around Senate reform with the base, and that never materialized. You know, to some extent, the same way Trudeau did maybe raise expectations among some progressives with, you know, electoral reform that didn't really materialize as well, too. I'll be curious what Poilievre does, because it's one where, again, I don't think anyone's going to vote on this issue, so I can't imagine it's going to be talked about in debates or in the election campaign.
And he's so disciplined on talking about issues that matter. He doesn't really go into these side conversations, to your point, that no one's voting on this, so Poilievre's not going to talk about it.
I can't imagine this will be like a big election issue, but if he does win the next election, like the first time he has to make decisions on Senate appointments, if it's going to be somebody who is a you know, a rabidly conservative partisan or former conservative fundraiser or something like that that goes in. I think there will be added scrutiny on that just because Trudeau did kind of move the process a bit in the other direction. So, yeah, I mean, that'll be interesting to see what he actually does after the fact, because there's a few precedences that have been set. You know, same thing, like if Poilievre wins, you know, Trudeau's kind of set the precedence of a gender balanced cabinet. I don't think Poilievre would do that. But by not doing that, it kind of becomes a news story that he didn't do it. Right. Because there's been a precedent set. So there's a few things like that that have been, you know, changed that, you know, if he does win the election, are going to be under a bit more scrutiny, I think.
Right. Look, everything he does will be under tremendous scrutiny, but he's also, he'll swat things away like he has been on every other issue. When it comes to Senate, I'm quite sure he'll be putting in big C and small C conservatives. They will be conservative ideologically. They'll fit his view of conservatism, and they will, they'll be obviously sit with the conservative caucus, because conservatives sit with the national caucus, right? They're still there. The numbers are getting low, though, right? Because I think there's 69 or 70 senators have been appointed by Justin Trudeau. Harper did leave 22 on the table when he was defeated in 15, which certainly shook things up. But for Senate reform, I think that issue of trying to like put in an elected Senate, we did have that throughout most of Harper's regime, was a open to the provinces if they would pay for the elections. That's who we would appoint.
Oh, yeah, I remember I lived in Alberta, so I was right. So, I saw Senate elections. I very purposely swilled my ballot every time on those. But
right, you still voted.
I do remember it happening. Yeah, for sure, as a thing. And you had these senators in waiting who just kind of went around calling themselves senators in waiting, but you know, didn't really wind up in the Senate. Oh, like he appoint one or two of them, I think.
Harper did.
Yeah,
Harper always did. Yeah, and Maroney did too, right? Yeah. When the act first came in. Whoever was elected during the provincial elections or municipal, I think it's provincial you have them. Whoever wins the Senate elections, I think it's a list you get, and it's for 5 years or whatever they say it holds up. And both Maroney and Harper picked from that list. And then Trudeau and every Liberal before that wouldn't obviously go with it. So the rumors of changes that we've heard about the Liberals and the NDP that they're doing, do you think it's anything actually could be bigger than tinkering, or is it?
I would expect it'll be things to increase voter turnout, because I do think that's something that at least would be seen as being nonpartisan. I'm sure, again, Poilievre will get up and say this is a secret Liberal NDP conspiracy to rig the election or something like that. But I think, you know, for that reason, because I think there'd be a sensitivity that if there was something that was seen as being, you know, dramatic or maybe too, you know, partisan, I think for that reason, they'll stay away from doing anything that's bigger than that. You know, I imagine there'll be things that will make it easier for people to vote, extra days of voting and or changing the advance polls or, you know, things like that that kind of facilitate, as you mentioned, mail-in voting, just making it easier for people to vote. So that's all I'm really expecting. You know, I'm open to be surprised, but I expect that'll probably be where it winds up on that one.
Okay, so we've talked about making it easier to vote, mail's becoming a bigger thing, and we've studied, this is one of the things we studied last election, because this was a pandemic election, the last one, and we were very worried about getting our people out to vote, and mail was becoming a bigger thing. But the research we did, and we see the exact same thing happen in the U.S., and we worked with a lot of U.K. firms on different parts of our campaign, and looked into the UK, it's fascinating how conservative voters really do not like voting by mail. So the more you increase, the easier it is to vote by mail, typically the more votes progressive voters get, Liberal or NDP. So,
and that's why you see when the US election results come in, it looks like the Republicans ahead, and then all the mail votes get counted and things start changing very quickly.
Yeah,
you have people
there
chanting, stop the count. And
right.
And, yeah.
Right. If they're adding extra days to vote, maybe that nulls, you know, makes it all equal, where conservatives have more opportunities to come out to vote in person. One thing we haven't talked about that's interesting, municipalities do it across the board, online voting. I find it, that just makes me nervous, and I don't know what that's rooted in. I've never seen anyone screw around in municipal campaigns to any level, but it makes me nervous, online voting. Is that something that could be coming down the pipe?
So that's something, I've done some polling questions on this, and I think most people actually share your opinion there. There's just not a lot of support for moving to online voting. People are very nervous about what that means from a sanctity of the election results. Personally, I mean, I do my banking online. I file my taxes online. I feel like if that's safe, we can find a way to make voting safe and not hackable. But, you know, especially...
But do we trust the banks more than the government, maybe? Is that the...
That's probably true. And I think especially coming out of this, like, Chinese interference, you know, world right. we live in now, I think it would be very difficult to move to any kind of online voting. So I think there'd just be that fear, whether or not it's founded or not, of, you know, foreign people hacking into our election results and changing them or anything like that.
And also, municipalities don't have political parties generally in Canada. Some provinces do. The vast majority do not. If you had a political machine, could you not maybe collect the ballots and the pins and maybe legally, but still like cast ballots for people? And you don't know who you're giving your ballot to, your pin to, if you're doing it online. I think that could be a concern too, right?
I could see that being an issue as well too. So I think, you know, for that reason, I couldn't see much going on with online. I do think mail is something where the rules could get tweaked to some extent. And I remember you mentioned, you know, you thought about this in the last campaign. I spent a lot of time in the lead up to the last election, just thinking about the mail-in voting phenomenon, because we'd seen a few provincial elections. And I think in the BC COVID election, it was something like a third of people or maybe even
right.
more
yeah,
than
the BC
voted
stuff,
by
that
mail.
Was,
like it was huge numbers for vote by mail. And obviously in the US, you know, same thing, huge vote by mail numbers. So, you know, we've been thinking a lot about, okay, are we going to encourage people to vote by mail or not? And, you know, in the end, the rules that were in place were rules such that I think if you requested a mail ballot, you no longer, your name got stricken off the voters list. So you could then couldn't show up on election day if you changed your mind. Or if you missed right. the deadline, you had to mail your vote at least, you know, 10 days before election day. So if you missed that deadline, you were kind of screwed. Whereas I know in some places, like in the US, you can show up on election day with your mail ballot and drop it off in a bin and things like that. Or it can arrive after the date. So, you know, I think maybe a system where vote by mail was made easier. You know, there's various degrees of vote by mail. Like, do you need to scan an ID and submit it to get a mail ballot, or can you just request it? So, you know, I think an easier form of vote by mail is something that maybe could be a move people might want to move into. Because I do think the rules in that do change a bit place to place, and the easier the rules are, the more people that will take advantage of it. So, you know, that's when I could see some movement on maybe.
It's funny, I mentioned how conservatives are generally not in favor of voting by mail. It, as you were talking, it just jogged my memory. Last every leadership race that I can remember, we vote by mail.
Yep.
So it's like we do this. Internally, we always are acceptable with these methods, but when it comes to the, maybe because we trust ourselves to manage the process and not the government or Elections Canada.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting dichotomy.
So one of the biggest electoral reforms I see constantly in Canada is how we choose our party leaders. Every decade or two, we seem to change the method of how we do it. That seems to be the only actual electoral reform. You know, it used to be delegated conventions, or it used to be some parties have one member, one vote. Some parties have weighted ridings. I believe the Liberal Party has weighted ridings, but free membership. Is that
correct?
Right. So we have weighted ridings. So every riding's worth 100 points, 343 going into the next election. And now the rules did change actually in the last two conservative conventions ago. The rules changed slightly where every riding was worth 100 points. Now it's worth up to 100 points. If you only have 50 members, your riding's only worth 50 points based on the votes. But that's the only change we get. In the US, their system's been the same for practically forever. Like, for how long?
I mean, even doing something that seems so obvious, like, you know, no longer just having Iowa and New Hampshire basically decide who the president is and mixing it up a little bit.
It's crazy.
There's so
system.
Much entrenched opposition to that.
Everyone
right?
just gives up, right? After New Hampshire, one of the smallest states, everyone just, oh, it's over. That one little place picked our candidate.
I know. And there's, you know, that seems like something that wouldn't be a dramatic change. I mean, we're not talking about, again, big overhaul versus small overhaul, just kind of, you know, randomizing the order of the states for primaries would be a small overhaul, but there's so much institutional resistance to that. Whereas in Canada, yeah, like every leadership race, the rules are at least somewhat different. Even if the, you know, the system is at the same level, the same, people change, you know, cutoff rules and entry fees and how you can vote, as you said. Sometimes it's by mail, sometimes it's in person. And there seems to be a lot more experimentation that goes on the leadership front. And I don't know what the reason is for that, to be honest. Maybe it is people just actually, I don't know what the reason is. Do you have an idea what the reason is?
It's fascinating. If you look at the UK, they had three conservative leaders in 1 year. And they kept going through their process quickly. And these were not just leaders, these were prime ministers of their country. In Canada, generally, when there's a leadership race, like the minimum is 6 months. Like, it's insane how long we do this. And I think it's the Americanization. We watch the U.S. primaries and we see how long that goes. And we've even shortened up our five-year election cycle to 4 years now with the fixed election date.
I will say it is true that Canadians do look at the Americans. And I remember once I was at a Liberal convention and there was a motion on the floor to basically like change the way the Liberals selected leaders to be a primary system. They're like, okay, first PI is going to vote, and then Nova Scotia is going to vote, and then Saskatchewan.
I was at that convention. I was there as a conservative.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting. Yeah, so,
observer.
You know, it's sort of a fascination Canadians always have with the U.S. system. We're doing some polling at Plera right now on U.S. election and what Canadians think about it. And, I mean, you know, there are more Canadians who have opinions of you know, Ron DeSantis then know who Scott Moe is. Like, it's just something we look
right
at the U.S. and we are always fascinated by the way they do it. And, you know, we do import a lot of the ideas up around campaigns that, you know, that they implement on. Although I guess we've never gone to the full-on primary system. But I do think the Liberal move to free memberships, when that happened, is something that people did kind of look at what was going on in the U.S. with like more people getting engaged when you pick a leader,
right,
and trying to make it more open, you know, similar to what the Americans do, where it is, you know, much, much more of a, you know, more people come out to vote in the primaries than in Canadians when you have to buy a membership and come out to vote.
Right. And it feels like it's a locked in part of their process where you do every 4 years, you go out and you vote who your candidate is if you're part of the party. Whereas you have to pay the money and be an actual member of the party. It's not just checking a box.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Poilievre did, I mean, to his credit, he did actually widen the interest in his leadership race to the point where there was, how many people, like 800,000 members signed up.
It was absolutely insane.
But most of the time in a leadership race, I mean, maybe, you know, 100,000, 200,000 people in a really big national race would vote. And I mean, that's a small percentage of the Canadian populace. So I think, you know, the reason the Liberals did move to that open system, I think, was to try to get more people involved in the leadership process. And then, you know, once they're involved, then you've got their phone number and their email address, and you can start hitting them up for donations and other things as well too. So,
yeah.
You know, that I think there's obviously the benefit there. But, you know, our leadership selection processes do seem to be a bit more insular than the states, where there's just so much, like, you know, big media attention going on what's happening right there right now. Whereas, you know, I think if you're trying to get news on a party leadership race, you kind of have to rely on podcasts and, you know, Twitter and things like that, as opposed to
media
the nightly
news. Yeah. Media does not cover leadership races at all at any real level that they do in the U.S. or in the U.K. even. We're really on our own pushing our own message. It's funny, in a leadership race in Canada, the most valuable tool. Now, again, the Poilievre leadership kind of blew the door off of that, and I think that was a different campaign that's hard to compare to. But traditionally, it's the party email list, getting the emails of the members from the Conservative Party or Liberal Party, in your case, that's the way you connect to your members. That's the only way to do it. And that's why, funny enough, just writing really good emails to the members is your top persuasion tool.
Yeah, I know. Like, I remember when O'Toole was running for leader, and obviously from a Liberal perspective, we were trying to figure out like who's going to win this race. And but there's not like a bountiful amount of information out there and polling. Like, you go right now to 538 or whatever, and there's like, you know, hundreds of polls on the primaries and what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
And you know, we're kind of throwing darts about like, is it going to be McKay or O'Toole or what's happening? And
well, all the public polling had McKay way ahead.
I know. So you're very much in the dark in terms of what's happening with the process compared to you know, in the states, where it's just you know, the numbers are out there, and it's just so much scrutiny on the process.
Yeah. And internally, we knew exactly who was going to win because we have that membership list. So we can ask, who are you voting for? Or once you voted, who did you vote for? In Canada, we tend to have these super long races. It could be 6 months. The UK does them quickly sometimes. The US has their process. We Americanize ourselves. But there's times in Canada where I remember when Patrick Brown went down, Ontario PC leader, I managed Christine Elliott's campaign. Those Doug Ford, Caroline Maroney, Tanya Granagallen, 6 weeks of chaos. But we did it in 6 weeks. And it was probably my favorite leadership campaign because it was so much fun, like, to build a team so quickly, because you're starting from nothing. You just have a candidate and an idea, and you got to build a whole team. And it was 6 weeks, and Doug Ford won. It was a good leadership race, and he's been, I think, a very good premier since, and it worked well. So it's like, why do we have these 6 months leadership campaigns when maybe we should shrink these up a bit?
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, there's logistical benefits maybe. I mean, it's easier for the people who work at the party, I guess. They get nervous there's something's going to go wrong, and then they're going to...
And a lot went wrong in that leadership.
Yeah, I know. Like,
there
was
a lot of delays.
The ballots
aren't
showing
challenges.
Up on time, and you get kind of that side of things. So, you know, I think that's part of it. But I think also there is this, as we talked about, this romanticism of the U.S. system where you have these long primaries and somebody emerges from nowhere and captivates the hearts and minds because of their compelling vision of the country. And they kind of get that lift off. And that doesn't usually really happen at the end of the day. It's more, you know, just sort of on the ground in the trenches, signing people up. But I do think there's always that kind of hope and dream that a longer race will give more opportunity for the best candidate to emerge from the field.
It's interesting. So the 2012 or 13 Liberal convention that was here in Ottawa, I think that's the one you mentioned where they had the vote to do the primary system. Instead, they voted to make it free membership, which was a big move at the time. And the party was at 35 seats. They were third place for the first time in history. It would have been fascinating if they went to the primary system to do that. I think that would have been very, at least entertaining as a political observer.
Although maybe it would have ended up looking like the U.S. primaries this time around, where, you know, Trudeau gets 90% in PEI, then Trudeau gets 80% in Saskatchewan, then Trudeau gets 78%.
Right.
You know, it wasn't the most competitive leadership race to follow.
That was a bad race to start. If you were
it may not have been, because I think when Jagmeet Singh won the NDP leadership, I think they had even set it up as a stage round of voting, where 1 week there'd be a round, then they drop the number of candidates into a second round, and then a third round. But he got over 50% on the first round, so it just sort of... That was it. There wasn't multiple rounds. So, you know, sometimes the system that is designed for an exciting race doesn't lead to that as an outcome.
And that's what's fascinating with Canada. Again, we keep coming up with these new systems every time there's a leadership race. There's very loose rules within the parties, and whoever the current executive is comes up with new rules.
And you try to correct for the last war, right? So like, the last time we had like 10 fringe candidates, so now we're going to raise the threshold for people to come in, and now there's only 3 candidates, so next time we're going to lower the threshold for people to come in. Or last time it was a chaotic 6-week race, so now we're going to stretch it out. So there's always that kind of correction and trying to fix the things that may have not worked as well in the last time around for a leadership race.
Right. So one last quick question. You're a pollster. You've run the polling for the last 3 Liberal campaigns. Who's going to win the next election?
Well, pollsters who make predictions often end up looking quite foolish after the fact. So, you know, I can tell you if the election were today, Poilievre would win.
Right.
But, you know, a lot can happen. And I think, you know, the last 8-9 months, we've seen big swings in the polls. And, you know, the next 8-9 months could see a big swing in the polls as well, too, especially if the economy improves or if the issue set changes. Like, I think part of the reason that the Conservatives are doing so well right now is because of this crushing pressure people are feeling because of high interest rates. I've done polling, and if you look at the difference between people who are paying down a mortgage and people who have paid off their mortgage among homeowners, the vote intent gap is 10 plus points there in terms of people who are paying down mortgages are just, they've left the Liberals, right? So I think, you know, if interest rates go down, that could change things. Or, you know, if the issue set changes, right? Like right now, if everyone's thinking about housing and the economy, it's hard for an 8-year Liberal government to win under that issue frame. If the big issue is healthcare or the environment or something else, in 2 years, that changes things. I mean, you've talked about this in respect to the 2021 campaign. Like when the issue set switched to vaccines and COVID, that was ground where the Liberals were trusted more, and that shifts people's intent. So if the ballot question changes, the polls will probably change as well too. So I will strategically not make a prediction here.
That's fair.
For fear of it being held against me in the future.
And it's a very good point. Issue sets change quickly, and as we saw in the 21 campaign, they changed within the week, right, in the last week of the campaign. So they can certainly change dramatically in the next year and a half. Look, thanks so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun, and hope to have you on again. Lots of stories I'm sure we can chat about from various campaigns and future campaigns.
Yeah, happy to be here. I think this has been I've listened to a lot of these podcasts that you've put out there, and I just love that you've pulled in this cross-partisan perspective and sort of unpacked different aspects of how politics operates in the country with people who have a bit of experience doing it. So kudos on the job, and I'll keep listening.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. All right, folks, thanks so much for listening in. This was a really fun podcast. It was really fun having Dan Arnold in. First time I ever met him. Used to read him for years as the Calgary Grit. And it was great to meet him face-to-face, and I hope to have him on again to have lots of conversations. We have lots of stories to tell, all on background. So please subscribe, send it to your friends. Let's keep growing this. And tune in next week for another episode of On Background.